This is KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in today. Tough, smart, terrifying. That's how some colleagues are describing Helen Summers today. She spent 36 years in the Washington State Legislature representing Queen Anne and Magnolia, and she died yesterday. U.S. Congressman Denny Heck spent 10 years in the legislature with Helen Summers, and he told me about one of her early re-election battles. 1976, the other Democratic representative for her district, Ken Eikenberry, decides to run against her.
Ken came to the inexplicable conclusion that the district wasn't big enough for the both of them. And so he cross-filed against her. Now, in state house districts, you can occupy position one or position two. And they did. And then Ken said, no, only one of us. And during that campaign, somebody went up on a billboard, which was a large picture of Helen Summers' face, and painted a mustache. And all of Helen Summers' people went nuts over it, talked about how disrespectful it was, and said, we got to get the billboard company to take it down now. And Helen was the only one who said, no, leave it up. She left it up. Ken Eikenberry was defeated. He was right. The district wasn't big enough for the both of them. It was only big enough for Helen Summers.
You have said that Helen Summers was not the warmest person to work with, except she surprised you. What happened?
So years after I served in the legislature, I came back to visit on the House floor one day. And mind you that when Helen was a member of the House Democratic Caucus, and I was as well, we would on occasion find ourselves on opposite side of leadership battles. Most notably when she ran for Ways and Means Committee Chair, I supported my friend Dan Grimm, who defeated her, but by a couple of three votes, as I recall. So Helen and I had kind of an up-and-down personal relationship, although there were times we were together. In any event, years later, I walked back out onto the House floor after they had immediately adjourned, and Helen was there, and she turned around and saw me and walked up to me and threw her arms around me and gave me like one of my lifetime, all-time favorite hugs. It was so uncharacteristic for her that I literally savor the memory to this day.
Why was that kind of warmth uncharacteristic of her? What was Representative Helen Summers all about?
Helen was all about policy and issues and analysis. She was a very analytical person, and that was her greatest strength as a legislator. She was extremely well-respected, especially on matters relating to fiscal issues, and it was because she did her homework. She did her homework, and then she did more homework, always had a command of the facts and the figures, and that's kind of the world that she occupied. And for it, she was very well regarded.
I have heard the word intimidating. Is that fair?
It's sexist. Helen was one of the early women leaders in the state legislature, and in fact, she was at the forefront of what would become, I think, the highest percent of women members of any state legislative chamber in America, in Washington State. And the fact that she was strong and she was tough often caused people to apply that label or that tag to her. And she was tough and she was hard-nosed, but I don't think intimidating or terrifying is fair at all. In fact, I think that reflects more on the person who would use that term and says more about their inability or insecurity to defend their position whenever they went toe-to-toe with her, because you better come prepared.
And we're talking with you on International Women's Day. You're talking about sort of a sexist attitude toward this longtime Olympia leader. How much do you think has changed in Olympia?
Some, but not enough. Obviously, we've actually regressed in terms of the percent of women who occupy membership seats in the State House of Representatives and the Senate compared to our high point. And there's still a lot of progress that can be made. And in fact, I think Helen Summers as a role model and an example is a good reason why we have made the progress we have, and an even better reminder of the progress we have yet to make.
That's Congressman Denny Heck. He represents Washington State's 10th District, the Puyallup-Olympia area in the United States House of Representatives. Said he worked with state legislator Helen Summers for a decade. Representative Summers served in the state house for 36 years. She died yesterday at the age of 84. It's KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. Seattle has a big Somali population, and some of those families have relatives in refugee camps. They are directly affected by the Trump administration's travel ban. KUOW's Kate Walters traveled to the Dadaab refugee camp in Kenya.
Here in the largest refugee camp in the world, there are two groups of people, haves and have-nots. The dividing factor comes down to family. There are those who have family who made it to a country like the US and those who don't.
I'd say 50% of the camp have people that came to US or either Canada or like places like that. And they depend on those people. They support their families. But then there's another half of the refugee camp that depend on what the UN gives them, and that's not really enough.
That's Yusuf. He's an engineer in Seattle, but he grew up in Dadaab, and he still has brothers back in the camp. We're not using his last name because he's concerned about the impact on his family. Yusuf sends money back to the camp for his brothers and makes sure they're taken care of.
I established a business for my two brothers, and that's how they kind of, you know, get to feed their families, you know.
When Yusuf moved to Seattle, his family went from having no one on the outside to having him. Mohammed Rashid is in the same situation. He's lived in Dadaab for over two decades without help. And then in 2015, his brother moved to Seattle.
They sent for me something, but before I was not having anything. But now at least they support me. So it is a great.
Rashid laughs easily. He's outgoing and tells me he has many friends. He has one of the nicest houses in the camp, partly because he's been here for so long and partly because his brother takes care of him. Some people live in glorified tents in Dadaab. Others live in more permanent structures like Rashid. Like many of the houses, Rashid's has a red dirt floor, and the walls are made from mud and sticks or cloth hung from a string. Unlike other houses, Rashid has a satellite dish and a TV, provided by his brother. But he and his family still face struggles. A tighter UN budget means that rations have been cut back, and that's hit everyone hard.
Sometimes you will not get lunch, you eat supper and you eat breakfast. Or sometimes you dodge for a supper, you eat lunch and breakfast. It's very difficult. You can't survive without your family.
The have-nots in the camp understand how hard it is to have no one on the outside. Salam Abdi Hadul was born just after his parents fled Somalia. He arrived in Dadaab when he was only a month old. By the time he was seven, both his parents had died. Hadul and his siblings were raised by their 14-year-old brother. They've never had anyone else to take care of them. I meet him in a small tea shop in Dadaab. He's wearing a neat white button-down and jeans. Hadul is polite and soft-spoken, but there's an undercurrent of desperation in his words.
Here, things are very, very difficult.
As we talk, his composure starts to slip.
I can't even realize my emotions. Just break it down. Things are very hard. Yeah.
Hadul has been in the camp for nearly 26 years. He's never left, and he feels imprisoned. He's been in the resettlement process for years, but after the Trump administration's travel ban, that process is on hold. And going back to Somalia is not an option. All he knows about that country is that it's plagued by conflict and drought. That leaves him with little opportunity. He doesn't have anyone abroad to help him start a business. He can't even afford to get married, because he knows he can't provide for a family.
I want you, but I don't have any support, you know. The situation here is so hard, so I need to marry, but I don't have anything.
Hadul doesn't want to raise children in the camp either. He remembers how hard his own childhood was, and he wants his kids to have more. But for now, the path out remains uncertain. Still, he has hope. Hadul's dream is to move to the US, go to college, and become an engineer.
You just take for us a message that we live here at the Dadaab camps for a long time. We are youth, we have a hope. For us now, our nationality, I can say, is refugee. Still, we don't have a nationality.
Hadul is hoping that a country like the US will step forward and finally give him a nationality. From Dadaab Refugee Camp, Kenya, I'm Kate Walters, KUOW News.
You'll hear more from our series In Limbo tomorrow here on KUOW Seattle. There are 11 million undocumented immigrants here in the United States. President George W. Bush and President Barack Obama both favored immigration reform that would have legalized their status. How come Washington, D.C. has failed to fix our immigration system? We're going to cover that this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. This is KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Deep Rye told police that he was working on his car in his driveway over the weekend when a white man wearing a mask walked up to him, shouted, "Go back to your own country," and shot him. Rye is a member of the Sikh religion, and the shooting is being investigated as a hate crime. According to a survey put out by the federal government, hate crimes are widespread, but the official numbers in the FBI's database don't necessarily reflect that. Investigative reporter A.C. Thompson is with ProPublica. He says one reason we don't have great numbers on hate crimes is there's no single definition of a hate crime.
The states have their own state hate crime laws, and those vary from place to place. And five states don't even have a hate crimes law. So Wyoming, Georgia, South Carolina, Indiana, Arkansas don't have the laws at all. In other states, different groups are covered. So some states cover gay and lesbians, some states don't. So there's variation there. There is a federal hate crimes law, and that obviously is uniform around the country. But what you get in these cases is most often they're prosecuted by state and local authorities, and those laws are very different. There's also an issue in that the federal government is the main source of data for hate and bias crimes. And this is through the FBI's crime reporting program. And the federal government has a mandate to go out and ask state and local authorities, hey, did you have any crimes of these types in your jurisdiction in the last 12 months? But a lot of those local police and sheriff's departments don't participate in that program. So about 20% of the departments around the country just don't participate. And they don't send anything on hate crimes to the FBI. Around 80 to 90% of the departments that do participate in the program claim quarter after quarter, year after year, that they don't have any hate crimes in their jurisdictions. And the evidence just doesn't support that. That looks like very shoddy or incomplete reporting.
Why would a local law enforcement department not report a hate crime to the FBI?
Well, you know, there's a lot of different reasons. The first piece of this is that they don't get paid to do this. They don't get funding to report this data to the FBI. And so some of them view it as extra paperwork that they just don't have time to do, and there's no mandate to do it. The other part of it is that what falls under the FBI's definition, the data that they're requesting, is pretty expansive. It covers crimes against people because of their ethnicity, because of their religion, because of their race, because of their gender, et cetera, et cetera. And in some places, those may not be particular hate crimes under that state law. So police may just generally not be collecting that type of information. And as well, there's a sort of disincentive in that if you're reporting, oh, well, we've had 10 horrible hate crimes in our county in the last year, you are making your county look perhaps not very nice. And since there's no funding attached to this to report accurately, there's sort of a disincentive to report.
Okay, so America's tracking of hate crimes sounds very uneven. Why does that matter?
You know, it matters for the following reasons. If you talk to criminologists and sociologists about this, the main way that we can sort of gauge the cohesion that we have as a society is through looking at these kind of statistics. Are African-Americans being attacked in a particular state? Are Muslims being attacked and harassed? Are gays and lesbians being attacked and harassed? And the hate crimes data is a real key way to understand if there are groups that are being singled out and targeted. So when you don't have a clear picture of how significant these problems are, you don't know how to address the problems, and you don't know where to direct resources.
You said some law enforcement groups don't really focus on hate crimes. Why would that be? I mean, the idea, I thought the whole idea behind extra punishment for a hate crime is because it's important to crack down on a crime against one that sort of functions as a crime against many. It's really important.
I can't speak to what goes into the mentality of law enforcement who are not focused on these crimes, but what I can tell you is, for example, in the most recent data, federal data, Mississippi claimed there were no hate crimes in that state. No, nobody who studies this believes that to be true. Other states, you know, would claim that they had 3 or 4 or 10, or you have Hawaii, which reports none, doesn't report at all to the federal government, you know, just doesn't even participate as a state in the program. And I don't know what the motivations are in these states and in these local jurisdictions for not reporting or not reporting accurately or not training officers well to document hate crimes, but I know that it's happening.
Well, you're not speculating, but bias comes to mind. Bias against any of these marginalized groups comes to mind.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely a thing to be concerned about. I think it's also that, look, I think probably an even broader problem is that in many places, police training in general is not great. It could be better. It could be more current. It could be more sophisticated. And I think what we've seen in instances with use of force in recent years in America is that the training on this in a lot of places isn't great. And you can bring that over to looking at bias crimes as well. And I think that there's a sort of failure to do the really great training that can be done in a lot of places on that issue. And I think that that's part of a more widespread problem with training of law enforcement.
How could we realistically do a better job tracking hate crimes?
One way is something that's been brought up in Congress several times, and that would be to tie grant funding coming from the federal government to actually reporting hate crimes to the federal government, to the FBI, and reporting it accurately. And there have been bills introduced in Congress to do this. And it's a pretty simple solution. I mean, I think that would be a big starting point.
Finally, AC, you've been reporting on this for ProPublica. What indication do you see that America is getting or will get better at tracking and reporting hate crimes?
There's sort of two trends, right? And one trend is really scary. And everyone who's looking at this believes that there has been an uptick in hate incidents in recent months. There is great concern that there is a surge in hate crimes and a surge in bias incidents. That's the scary part. The hopeful part is that there is concern, and there's a lot of people looking at this right now in the public sector, in the media sector, in the nonprofit sector. And I think that that attention, for example, everybody in the Senate calling on the federal government to do more about anti-Semitism is a hopeful sign.
A.C. Thompson's been investigating hate crimes and the way we track them and don't track them for a series in ProPublica. We are tweeting out a link to one of those stories right now at KUOW. Look up, look out at the Seattle skyline. I guarantee you'll see yellow tower cranes. They're all over Bellevue. They're coming to other parts of the region, which prompted a question for KUOW's Local Wonder.
My name is Ben Lang. I live in University District in Seattle. I've heard that the only city in the world that has more cranes up right now is Dubai. Is that true? How many construction cranes are up in Seattle right now, and how does that compare to other cities in the world?
Thank you, Ben. To answer Ben's crane-counting question, we sat out reporter Carolyn Adolph of KUOW's Region of Boom team.
Dubai is like Las Vegas and Disneyland, all under construction at once. We're talking the tallest buildings on the planet, fantastical projects, hundreds of cranes. We're talking over 900. How can anyone compete? Seattle doesn't, which is why it is not second only to Dubai. Though one may be fooled while walking through South Lake Union, Seattle only has about 60 cranes, which is not at all close to the hundreds in Dubai. Seattle doesn't even have the most cranes in North America. That title goes to Toronto. They win at 80. But Toronto's situation is similar to Seattle's. Both cities have lots of million-dollar houses and people who can't buy them, so developers are building apartments and condos. Seattle does have more cranes than San Francisco and Los Angeles, and we're slightly ahead of Chicago, clocking in at around 50. What's interesting is to see cranes popping up well beyond Seattle's downtown.
I'm looking at three big cranes visible from my house right now.
This is Christopher Reed of Renton, who contacted us on Twitter about the construction near his place.
They're all yellow, and they get lit up red and green and blue at night. Looks pretty cool.
When I'm in my nursing home looking out the window, I hope to see the lights on it. Everybody's cranes in December.
This is Jackie Garner.
And our business name is Garner Construction.
And she's proud of how Seattle's cranes dress up for the holidays. Garner's company supplies the operators for many of the city's cranes. How many cranes is she operating?
16.
16? And there's like 16 town, and you've got 16.
That's correct. And if I've done it right, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
The list is up on a whiteboard in Garner's office.
17, actually. Sorry, 17.
17 cranes.
We have two more going up on next week. So by spring, we should have about 27 jobs.
So business is good. Garner says it feels like the boom before the Great Recession.
I think that this one probably will last a little bit longer. I think we're at least 5 or 6 years out of having a good economy for this.
And at Garner's company, they do it all.
We rent the crane, we erect the crane, we operate the crane, we maintain the crane, and we take the crane down.
How do cranes come down?
They're taken down in pieces, and they are then taken back to the yard, which is in Salem, where they go through them and make them ready for the next job.
So the cranes live in Oregon?
Yes. Yep.
But the cranes are not getting much time to rest, and it looks like they'll be stretching higher. The city of Seattle is raising building heights, first in the University District, then downtown and everywhere else. Part of a grand bargain with developers, exchanging more height for affordable units. However, you never hear anyone say they're building the world's tallest skyscraper in Seattle, or an underwater hotel, or a rotating condo building that's its own wind power station. All of that is happening in Dubai. For Local Wonder, I'm Carolyn Adolph with KUOW's Region of Boom team.
So how many cranes can you see right now? We're asking you on Twitter, at KUOW. Dan says he sees 18 cranes in Eastlake. Remarkable. Top that, at KUOW. One of our producers is skeptical of Dan's 18 reported cranes. I don't know. It's possible. We'd have to triangulate that. See, where would you have to be to see the maximum number of cranes? That'd be a good question. We're tweeting at KUOW. You're listening to The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in today. We're going to hear some poetry this hour still. We're going to hear from Vaughn Palmer in a few minutes, too. First, though, Washington State's prison system had a spike in suicides in 2014 and 2015. 11 inmates died. Four of those suicides happened at the Airway Heights Correctional Center near Spokane. In part three of our series, KUOW's Austin Jenkins takes us inside that prison to find out what happened. I warn you, this story includes descriptions of suicides.
The first suicide of 2014 at Airway Heights Prison was in April. Tony Lee Willoughby. He was found hanging from the bed in his two-man cell. Willoughby was nearly 30 years into a life without parole sentence for murdering an 87-year-old woman. The second suicide came the following month. Morgan Bluehorse, age 29, had just arrived at the prison 2 days before. He was found hanging 5 hours after he was placed in a solitary cell for his own protection. The third suicide happened in August. Chance Kidder hanged himself in his solitary cell. He was just 19. At the time, Maggie Miller Stout was the superintendent at Airway Heights. She's now retired. Miller Stout says in 40 years on the job, 3 completed suicides in 4 months in the same prison was almost unheard of.
It was sobering. It was, holy shit, what's next? How did we miss it? We're good at preventing this sort of thing. How did this happen?
It wasn't supposed to happen, especially at a prison like Airway Heights. It's a more modern facility designed for direct supervision. That means the staff spend their days in amongst the inmates. They get to know them, know their personalities, know when something's wrong. Miller Stout says the suicides shook her staff's confidence in their ability to recognize an inmate in trouble, to intervene before a suicide. The men who had died weren't even on the radar of the prison's mental health staff. Chief psychologist Lou Sowers recalls what was going through his mind at the time.
I'm scared. I'm wondering if we have a contagion issue. What are we missing? Should we be doing anything differently?
For Miller Stout, suicide was a personal issue.
My grandfather committed suicide when my father was 3 years old, and my best friend committed suicide in 1992. It's never been far from my mind.
Miller Stout and Sowers put their heads together, and they identified three categories of inmates that they felt deserved more attention. Recent arrivals at the prison, young inmates, and inmates new to segregation. In other words, inmates like Chance Kidder.
The fact that this kid had just gotten here, and he was so young, and at least with the initial information we had, there was no predictors. And that was one of the things that was quite mystifying, the self-inflicted gunshot to his chest. We didn't have any idea that that's what that was. He himself misled the staff.
Every time you arrive at a new prison, you get asked a set of questions about your physical health and your mental health, and specifically about suicide. When Chance arrived at Airway Heights, he denied past suicidal feelings or attempts. His official prison record listed his gunshot wound, but it read more like an accidental shooting than a suicide attempt. And no one had investigated it further.
And the fact that that information existed but wasn't available was real frustrating.
Had that information been available, Miller Stout says Chance would have gotten more attention when he arrived at Airway Heights.
He would have risen up the ladder to having more priority for services than he did.
The rash of suicides at Airway Heights and across the Washington Department of Corrections in 2014 and 2015 revealed gaps and shortcomings, and eventually led to system-wide policy changes. But those changes did not come quickly. Airway Heights Prison sits on a windswept plateau west of Spokane. It was built in the early 1990s, and the sprawling complex holds more than 2,000 minimum and medium security inmates. Last June, I visited the prison and took a tour. James Key is the current superintendent. He led me through a series of high-security doors to an isolated part of the prison even most inmates never see.
So, this is segregation.
Segregation is prison speak for solitary confinement. This is where you go if you get in trouble or if you need protection. It's where Chance Kidder and Morgan Bluehorse were when they hanged themselves. The inmates call this place the hole. But on first impression, segregation is bright and clean. It's got soaring ceilings to accommodate two tiers of stacked cells. Key led me across a tiled atrium to an empty cell where we waited for an officer in the control room to electronically open the door.
Come on in.
I stepped into cell number 4, and immediately I thought to myself, I could not spend 23 hours a day in here. It was cramped, 15 feet long by 6 feet wide. There was a built-in metal shelf along the back wall, a narrow cot with a very thin mattress. Just a couple of feet from the bed, there's a stainless steel sink and toilet combination unit. You get a bit of daylight filtered through two narrow windows, and you're in here basically all day long. It's not clear how long Chance had been hanging before he was discovered, but when officers did find him, they cut him down and immediately began CPR. They got a faint heartbeat back, and he was taken to the hospital.
Watch out for, watch out for.
Chance died the following afternoon. When an inmate dies by suicide in prison, it takes a toll on the staff. Officer Zoltan Siglani has worked at Airway Heights for 20 years. He was on duty the day of another suicide, inmate Tony Willoughby.
When I arrived, we had already a unit officer and one of my co-worker responsive movement officers untying the noose that he had around the bed. He had a knot around the bed, and then he also had one around his neck.
And Officer Siglani was one of the first to respond. He says when he got to the cell, two other officers had already cut Willoughby down. Siglani says they called for a hook knife. That's a special kind of tool that's kept in each of the prison's living units just for this situation. Picture a fish hook-shaped knife with serrated teeth. They're specifically designed to cut through sheets or other materials an inmate might use to hang themselves. There are 9 of these knives at Airway Heights.
To get your finger in there and work that in there, obviously you have gloves on, so you have a little bit of hindrance. And then, of course, to get that tool in there as well. So it was very difficult, not to mention the adrenaline that is going through your body.
Once he was able to cut the sheet, they began CPR.
The individual at the time was very pale in color. I could tell that rigor mortis had kind of set in.
Rigor mortis sets in after someone is dead. But even if there is rigor mortis, the policy in the prison is that officers must begin CPR.
The tightness of the skin, the clamminess, when you're actually performing the CPR, the breaking of the sternum, the movement of the air and what that sounds like, it's a wheezing sound. And all that you're taking in.
Correctional officers are not allowed to pronounce someone dead. And until someone is pronounced dead, they have to perform CPR. At another prison, officers had to do CPR on an inmate who died after slitting his arm and bleeding out overnight. The officers traded off performing chest compressions for about 15 minutes before an ambulance crew arrived, and that's when Willoughby was declared dead. The next day, Siglaney was back at work. There was paperwork to fill out, there's a formal stress debriefing to sit through. And then it was back to the routine. But Siglaney says he was changed.
The way I look at individuals and some baseline behaviors that I might question. I might just ask them, hey, how are things going? How's your day going? Stuff like that. So maybe just paying attention to some of those kind of things more so now than I have in the past, just because there was a life that was taken. In front of me, and I think it always will change me.
Everyone I spoke with at Airway Heights said the suicides in 2014 changed them, made them more tense, more alert, more attuned to subtle changes in inmate behavior. After the suicides, officers started referring more inmates to mental health, and more inmates were self-referring. The mental health staff was already taxed. There were just 7 of them for 2,200 inmates. Superintendent James Key was the assistant superintendent of the prison at the time. He says after each suicide, there was just a growing sense of helplessness.
We're fixers, and we get it done. When you talk about the spike in the suicides, we want answers, and we're people who get answers, but none of the indicators showed anything.
But there was something they could have fixed at Airway Heights, but didn't, at least not right away. Picture a metal cage that covers the fire sprinkler head in the isolation cells. This is what Chance Kidder and Morgan Bluehurst had used to hang themselves. The cage was there to protect the sprinkler head because inmates would break the sprinkler and flood their cells. But the diamond-shaped holes in the cages were just big enough to thread a strip of sheet through. Records obtained from the Washington Department of Corrections reveal that frontline staff at Airway Heights considered the cages a problem for years. But in the words of one officer, getting them replaced was like pulling teeth. After the death of Morgan Bluehorse, Maggie Miller Stout asked her staff to research an alternative, but the cages were still in place nearly 3 months later when Chance Kidder hanged himself. And it took another month after that before they were finally removed.
We wanted to replace it, but didn't feel a tremendous sense of urgency. It did reach that point, but not as soon as, in hindsight, I wish we had.
Miller Stout says her focus was on trying to identify which inmates were suicidal.
The fact of the matter is, if somebody really wants to kill themselves, they will succeed, guaranteed. So what we needed to do is try to figure out how to get men to decide that that wasn't a viable option, that there's other things, and give them hope in other ways.
She started counting the days and the weeks that passed with no suicides in her prison.
Please, let us get through 1 month. Let's get through 2 months. Are we still doing all the right checks? Are we doing all of the details right?
Tomorrow, in part 4, the prison system brings in an outside expert to help and begins to make changes to prevent future suicides. I'm Austin Jenkins reporting.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. News and information, I'm Bill Radke. Right before the November elections, Louise Mensch reported that U.S. authorities had sought FISA warrants to monitor Trump associates. The White House pointed to her reports to substantiate Trump's claim that President Obama wiretapped him at Trump Tower. Louise Mensch says she never said that. You'll hear the story this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. Be Bold for Change is the name of a Town Hall Seattle event tonight, celebrating this International Women's Day. The Gates Foundation is marking the day in South Lake Union. And on Capitol Hill, Rachel's Ginger Beer is toasting International Women's Day with an event called Bottoms Up for Babes. And KUOW's Elizabeth Austin is here with a poem that connects an iconic feminist voice from the mid-19th century with today's immigration debate. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hey, Bill.
What have you brought us?
I want you to hear this reading by Seattle civic poet Claudia Castro Luna. So she performed at Town Hall on Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. It was part of Writers Resist, which was a night of readings all over the country to celebrate democratic ideals like free speech and inclusion.
And what did Claudia Castro Luna read?
She created this powerful call and response across history. So she began by reading Ain't I a Woman by Sojourner Truth. Mm-hmm. She was the 19th century abolitionist and activist for women's rights who had been born into slavery. So Ain't I a Woman is based on a rousing testimonial that Sojourner Truth is thought to have given at a women's rights convention in Akron, Ohio in 1851. So as we listen, you'll hear how Claudia Castro Luna responds to Sojourner Truth with her own testimonial.
Ain't I a Woman? Speech delivered by Sojourner Truth at the 1851 Women's Convention in Akron, Ohio. Well, children, where there is so much racket, there must be something out of kilter. I think that twixt the Negroes of the South and the women at the North, all talking about rights, the white man will be in a fix pretty soon. But what's all this here talking about? That man over there says that women need to be helped into carriages and lifted over ditches and to have the best placed everywhere. Nobody ever helps me into carriages or over mud puddles or gives me any best place. And ain't I a woman? Look at me. Look at my arm. I have plowed and planted and gathered into barns, and no man could heed me, and ain't I a woman? I could work as much and eat as much as a man when I could get it, and bear the lash as well, and ain't I a woman? I have borne 13 children and seen most old sold to slavery, and when I cried out with my mother's grief, none but Jesus heard me, and ain't I a woman? Then they talk about this thing in the head. What is it they call it? Intellect. That's it, honey. What's that got to do with women's rights or Negroes' rights? If my cup won't hold but a pint, and yours holds a quart, wouldn't you be mean not to let me have my little half measure full? Then that little man in black there, he says women can't have as much rights as men because Christ wasn't a woman. Where did your Christ come from? Where did your Christ come from? From God and a woman. Man had nothing to do with him. If the first woman God ever made was strong enough to turn the world upside down all alone, these women together ought to be able to turn it back and get it right side up again. And now they is asking to do it. The man better let them. Obliged to you for hearing me, and now old Sojourner ain't got nothing more to say. But I, Claudia Castro Luna, have a few things to say. There is a man over there soon to occupy the highest office in the land who says immigrants are rapists, criminals, the worst kind of people. I have never committed a crime, have paid taxes every year of my adult life, have worked to earn an honest wage, and am I not an immigrant? He says immigrants take away from everyone, and for this they should be rounded up by the millions and deported. They should be banned and blacklisted for worshiping in a way that differs from his. I studied hard to obtain an education and work to educate children in public schools and every day commit to lead a life worthy of my parents' sacrifice, who knew this country was by no means perfect, but it offered us refuge and hope. And am I not an immigrant? That man over there may well say, you are an exception. But let me tell you, all of us in my immigrant family, my immigrant friends, and the many immigrant brothers and sisters, none of us lead our lives to cheat, deceit, take advantage of anyone or any system. We love our kin like everyone else and aspire to a fulfilled life. The immigrants I know are nurses, teachers, doctors, day laborers, professors. They own businesses, clean school buildings, compose music, make sculptures, write poems, and all are dreamers. From its dawning, where did the majority of this country's population come from? Where did it come from? From other places, other countries. The exceptionalism of this country resides in that very fact, in the respect and wonderment of difference. Let her who can produce a birth certificate immune to the waves of immigration to this country speak to the grandeur of this land before it was bound to Western laws. Otherwise, the road is made by walking together, juntos, together, todos juntos. Thank you for listening.
Wow. Todos juntos. I don't even care your politics. Just how do you not feel the power of that?
Exactly.
That was Seattle's civic poet, Claudia Castro Luna, reading for a live audience at Writers Resist, an event recorded in January at Seattle's Town Hall. And that poem was called Am I Not an Immigrant? And Elizabeth, why is that the poem you wanted to bring to us for International Women's Day?
It's kind of staggering to me, Bill, that more than 150 years after Sojourner Truth spoke at that convention, the world is still so divided over issues of race, feminism, and immigration. And because Claudia not only brings in Sojourner Truth's voice, but she parallels her rhetorical structure, she's created this kind of call and response that connects the past with our present struggle with all those issues in a visceral way.
What a great idea to call back to those words. It's all part of our shared language, and then put it in the now.
Exactly. That's exactly what poets do.
I like hearing the poem read live, too. That was so powerful.
And as you said, she carries the audience with her. That's that element of that call and response, that bringing of people together, juntos.
And again, that's our civic poet in Seattle, Claudia Castro Luna. And what is her immigration story, Elizabeth?
So Claudia fled the war in El Salvador in the early 1980s with her parents and her sister. And I should tell you, Bill, we've actually got a link to a short essay Claudia wrote on her blog about the contrast between the welcome that her family received back then and the climate now for refugees and immigrants. You can also hear more from Writers Resist, including a couple of really powerful poems from Seattle's youth poet laureate, Angel Gardner, and that'll be, of course, at our website, kuow.org.
Live poetry with an audience, the Writers Resist event, including Claudio Castro Luna's reading. It was recorded by KOW's John O'Brien and Elizabeth Austin. Thank you so much for bringing that in.
Thanks for listening, Bill.
As we said, today is International Women's Day, and there is a day without a woman strike. Organizers asked women to strike from paid and unpaid labor to limit shopping and to wear red in solidarity, all a way to highlight women's collective economic might. And what kind of impact will all of this have? We'll report on that later this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. KUOW Seattle, I'm Bill Radke. When President Trump vowed to build Keystone XL and other oil pipelines, he was very clear.
I want the pipe to be manufactured with United States steel.
Well, it looks like that won't happen after all. The Keystone Pipeline is owned by a Canadian company. Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer joins us live. Hiya, Vaughn.
Hi, Bill. Happy International Women's Day.
Happy International Women's Day. Let's talk international pipelines now. How come this pipeline company, TransCanada, is exempt from Trump's American steel requirement?
It appears they're going to be exempt for a couple of reasons. First of all, the pipeline is under construction. In fact, it would have been finished if it hadn't been for some of the obstacles south of the border. The second thing is they've ordered the steel already, and a bunch of it is actually coming from the United States. About half the pipe is coming from a company in Arkansas. Another big chunk of the order is being milled by an American company with American iron, but at a mill in Canada. So that, I guess you'd call international. And about a quarter of it is on order from, I think India and Italy. So we're only half to two-thirds of the way there. The project's already underway, so it looks like they might give the project an exemption.
Okay, good enough for the Trump administration this time. We're going to let you slide, Vaughn. The oil pipeline between Alberta and Canada, and Nebraska is that section of the Keystone Pipeline we're talking about. I want to switch to some human beings crossing the border because I understand that Victoria school children are staying away.
Yeah, we're seeing actually a bunch of school districts in Canada that are looking at this, but the one here in the provincial capital in Victoria has announced they're going to suspend all school trips south of the border until the immigration issue, the Trump immigration edict, is sorted out. So these are banned trips, school athletics, things like that. The school district has a lot of them, and they're saying they don't want... We've got people here who have dual citizenship. Some of them may be from countries that are on the watch list or the banned list. And until all that is sorted out, the school district, they don't want to be in a position where they say, yes, you know, the band can go or the team can go and some of their friends are going with them and then they get stopped at the border and turned back. Been a couple of cases already where that's happened with Canadian students. So basically, they're just going to hold off till everything gets sorted out down there. And I'm sure that'll happen any day now, right?
Yes, sorting out is what we do here. No chaos in the USA. You have maybe heard that President Trump has revised the travel ban. I suppose that hasn't reassured schools yet. Anyway, we're still sorting it out.
I think they're still consulting their experts on that. They say they will, you know, if there's an urgency thing like a band trip that's in the next few weeks and everything is fine, they'll let that one go. They're going to approve them on an as needed basis. But at the moment, a lot of it's on hold. And as I say, other school districts are looking at the same thing.
Finally, Vaughn, Seattle Repertory Theater co-produced a musical, a bit of a love letter to Canada, actually. And I understand your prime minister's headed to Broadway.
Yeah, I'm really sorry I didn't see Come From Away in Seattle. I only heard about it after it was over. But Come From Away is now on its way to Broadway. I think the official opening is the 12th of March. The Canadian consulate in New York is holding a special showing bought all the tickets for a special showing on the 15th of March, and the Prime Minister and his wife are going down. People in Seattle who've seen the musical know the story, but basically it's about how the little town of Gander, Newfoundland, hosted thousands of travelers when the big European jumbo jets coming out of Europe had to put down in Gander on 9/11. Mm-hmm. Remember, they closed the airspace. So I think, as I seem to recall reading, that the number of people who arrived by airplane exceeded the number of people in the town. But a very heartwarming story, a great moment in Canada-U.S. relations, and inspired that some people wrote a musical about it.
I understand that Prime Minister Trudeau once taught high school drama, which I didn't know.
Yeah.
And,
yeah. He did. He taught high school drama in Vancouver. He taught snowboarding as well. I'm not sure he puts that on his resume, but anyway.
And that there's also a kind of political affinity that Prime Minister Trudeau might have to this sort of cross-border welcoming story on Broadway.
Yeah, welcoming people is a theme of it. Cross-border friendship is pretty important, too, and I'd say that's one of the great moments in Canada-U.S. history was how well we adjusted to 9/11. A lot of planes went in and landed in Vancouver, too, but Vancouver's a big city. I mean, Gander, Newfoundland is a little place. It's got a very big runway, but it is not a big town. So those people were really hard-pressed to accommodate their visitors, and yet they did.
And finally, Vaughn, we have a little time to just let people know that you are continuing to watch the cross-border traffic, which we've been talking about for a few weeks, but we are going to see the frozen tundra finally softening over the coming weeks.
You know, that's a very good point, Bill. People, refugees from the United States, have been coming to Canada and seeking asylum here or refugee status here because of the situation in the United States. We've had a lot of crossings considering the weather in eastern Canada, Manitoba, frozen fields, people walking across them in Quebec. We had a couple of people arrested, crossed into the border just out of Washington State one day last week, 5:30 in the morning, seeking asylum as well. But as the weather warms, I have to think the numbers are going to increase. It's people are putting up with enormous hardship now. It's going to get easier. And the Canadian government still hasn't figured out what it's going to do about this. They're really quite torn on how to deal with this challenge, really. It's I guess you'd call it a problem, but really it's just a challenge of how do you accommodate these people that are, many of them, legitimate refugees leaving the United States and coming to Canada and seeking the status they don't think they'll get in the United States anymore.
Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Always good to talk with you, Vaughn. Thank you.
Bye-bye, Bill.
And talking of warmer weather across the U.S.-Canadian border, let's end the program here back in the States, where the USA would have had its warmest February ever if it were not for us. The Federal Climate Agency, NOAA, says it was unseasonably warm for most of the country east of the Rockies. Average temperature 41.2 degrees. That's more than 7 degrees warmer than normal. Chicago had no snow in February. Oklahoma hit 99 degrees. Seriously, 99 in Oklahoma. Local records fell, but it's been different here, of course. Seattle had its coldest winter in 32 years. February in the Northwest has been chilly, so because of us, the national warmth record stands. It was not broken. Sorry, America, you did all that winter sweltering for no payoff. If it makes you feel better, we got thunder snow here.